Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, June 19th, 2011, and this is show number 317. Well, I bet each week as you listen to the show, you've been thinking, I sure get a great lot of value out of this. I just wish there were some way I could help. As it turns out, there's a lot of ways you can contribute to the success of the show. Let's say you buy a lot of stuff at Amazon. Consider using the little Amazon search box in the left-hand sidebar at podfeet.com. In fact, you could create a bookmark, call it Amazon, but have it be podfeet.com. Anyway, anything you buy after searching through that little box will throw around 3% towards funding the show. And you didn't even have to buy anything you wouldn't have bought anyway. Everybody wins. If you don't use Amazon, maybe you just want to click that big PayPal button to donate once in a while. You could try that. How about buying something from one of our sponsors? If you purchase ScreenSteps or Text Expander or anything else from Smile, it helps keep the show going. Be sure to tell them you're a No Silicast listener when you buy, so they know we sent you. Another big way to contribute to the show is to do audio reviews of software and hardware and websites, little tools that make you happy, like Stu and Jans did this week. I finally made an instructional sheet over at podfeet.com called Record Your Own Review. Gives you some guidance about the best way to record, how to send it to me, and how long to make it. These instructions are right there in the menu bar. One last way to help is to throw a review up over on iTunes on the show page. That helps us rise in the rankings. Rising in the rankings brings in more listeners. More listeners equals more fun and more advertising dollars. So again, everybody wins. Thanks for considering some of these options. And of course, you can always just sit and listen and enjoy. Maybe tell a friend. All right, let's get started with the first listener review.
Hello, listeners. This is Jans from Frankfurt again with a review of the Remember the Milk for iPad and iPhone app. I can't tell you how much I've been waiting for this RTM for iPad app. It's been less than a year, but it felt like ages. And now, ta-ta, there it is, the Remember the Milk iPad app. But first of all, one question. Do you know RTM at all? Okay, here you go. RTM is the best, most underestimated task management app I know. RTM, first of all, is a web service that allows you to manage your tasks, save them with a due date, assign context like places, persons, projects to them, and keep the tasks out of your precious mind until it's time to work them out. RTM is fully configurable according to your needs, so you can add smart lists, create separate business and private lists, keep your tasks sorted by project, places, persons, or every term you've got in mind. RTM is a full-blown GTD application with all the bells and whistles and has the best price-benefit ratio one can imagine, since it's absolutely free of charge in the basic edition. Only if you want to sync more than once a day with your handheld device, you need to pay $25 per year for a pro account that is far more than worth its money. You can use email, Twitter, SMS, the web service, and your iDevice to enter tasks. It is also easy to forward an entire mail to the web app, exchanging the subject line by a coded task description that can also be generated by a text expander snippet, or just send it to your RTM account's inbox to deal with it later. Very efficient for quick entries. The iPhone version is already out for more than a year, and I was using it on a regular basis since then. It is a perfect match to the web app, syncs perfectly via 3G or Wi-Fi, and can be used intuitively by everybody who knows about task management. From my point of view, it is far better configurable than Things or others. Being reprogrammed for the iPad, it now uses the full resolution of the iPad screen and shows different views of the to-dos. This screen view. On the very left, it shows the views for this week based on today, tomorrow, this week's tasks. Fourth in line, it shows the lists view, where you can find all the lists you have made, including smart lists, in an alphabetical order. Tags are good enough to gain control of your tasks. But compared to the smart lists provide even more possibilities, since you can combine searches or create convenient searches, like for untagged items, all items to be done within the next 7 days, or so on. Next comes the list by tags. This view automatically groups all tags in an alphabetical order and provides the best view on phone lists, where the tag is at phone, or groceries to do, where the tag is at supermarket. Then there is a special view that might be interesting for you, the places view. The places view provides an opportunity that I only know from RTM. It groups tasks geographically and allows a proximity search if you have prepared location tags to be added to the tasks. In real life, it works like this. Let's presume you have a bunch of stores you usually do your errands in. A one-time job is now to list all these stores in the Places menu on the web app by marking them on a built-in Google Map interface. Then you allocate the tasks to these shops, and when you are in town, you can look up the locations next to where you are in the proximity search or proximity view. This works in line with the Places view and the GPS sensor or location service. In case you have defined some places, you can now see those that are within the defined proximity and the tasks to be done there. Next comes the search window, in which you can look up for the entries you've made or define your own searches using the RTM search language. Last but not least, you find the settings by tapping on the little cogwheel icon below the above said views. The graphical user interface is nice and chic. It shows the menu, white on black, then the submenu, black on light blue, and the content is shown black on white. You can choose between the done and the due items view, and if you have more items than are fitting on one page, you can scroll the list up or down at your choice. All mentioned features are available for the iPhone version as well, but the iPad version is far better to handle and you have a much better overview. The entries are far easier to do since the keyboard is better to handle and much bigger. I'm pretty happy with the iPad version and I think that the iPad is now one step closer to a work machine again. Thank you, Allison, for letting me present my review on your podcast. Your podcast really rocks. Keep on going.
Thank you so much, Jans, for the kind words. It's a labor of love, that's for sure. You must be an incredibly organized person. I'm kind of jealous, actually. I love apps like this, but I have a bad habit of setting them all up, putting in a bunch of stuff I have to get done, and then completely ignoring them when it's time to get stuff done. I probably have 7 or 8 separate apps sprinkled between my iDevices and my Mac, and then I'll sit down to get productive and I'll read my email instead. Or I'll do the thing that's on the post-it note that's actually stuck on the desk. Someday I'm going to be organized, though, I promise. I probably will try Remember the Milk from rememberthemilk.com. When the Mac Defender malware first hit, I wanted to tell my kids and my in-laws how to turn off save files when downloading in Safari. I bet you did the same thing, being well-informed geeks that you are. Well, how did you tell them? Did you write a verbose email trying to describe the sequence to follow? I sure didn't. I whipped open ScreenSteps, took a few screenshots, annotated them to point at the checkboxes to click and the menus to choose, and then I typed in an explanation of what they needed to do and, more importantly, why. Unfortunately, I forgot to tell my neighbor across the street and her daughter ended up getting Mac Defender. I felt really bad about that. The good news is she was able to scrape it off using the instructions from Apple. After she was clean again, I realized I should send her the instructions. Instead of having to write a whole new email, I was able to pop in my short ScreenSteps lesson and hit send without recreating anything. And that's when the real power of ScreenSteps comes into play. If you do something once, doing a couple screenshots and some text, it's worth ScreenStepping it because you're bound to have to do it again. If you haven't bought ScreenSteps yet, I hope I've convinced you to do it now. So head on over to ScreenSteps.com, check out the free trial. When you inevitably do buy it, be sure to tell them you heard about it on the NoSillaCast. Don't forget to enter your name, too, over at bluemangolearning.com/clarify to get early notification of their new product called Clarify when that comes out, too. There's a link in the show notes so you don't have to write that down. Head on over to bluemangolearning.com.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
How do I? What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Okay, this is a question for the Dumb Question Corner. And this is Kim from the chat room. And my problem is that I am typing a sentence, and in the sentence it has a number which is to a certain power. So like, let's say 10 to the 10th power. And my question is on a Mac using a wireless keyboard, how do you type that number? Like, how do you type 10 to the 10th power? And that's really all my question is. And bye.
Well, after listening to Kim's question, I asked her what application she was using because it actually changes the answer quite a bit. More sophisticated word processors include a keystroke combination to go to super or subscript, but simpler text editors, email programs, etc. may not include that as a feature. She told me she was using Notational Velocity, but planned to upgrade to Pages at some point. That was good because that's sort of both ends of the spectrum. I did some doodling around in a few programs, and I found a somewhat standard option. In Word, if you use Command, Shift, and hit the plus sign, you'll be in superscript mode. I was hoping Microsoft was smart enough to make Command-Shift minus subscript, but of course they didn't do that. It's Command-Shift equal sign. What's wrong with those people? Why don't they pick the obvious things? Anyway, I went to Pages to see what you use there, and I found that it also says to use Command-Shift plus. But there's a bug in it. It only makes the font bigger instead of doing the superscript. Now, Command-Plus is supposed to make the font bigger, so it's like it's not recognizing the Shift key in the sequence. I wanted to make sure it wasn't just me, so I asked my Twitter followers, and they all verified that the keystroke doesn't work for them either. You can use the menus to get to it. Just a simple little pick of Format, Font, Baseline, and then choose Superscript. Well, that's an awful lot of work. Luckily, Kyle Mag and B. Sailor and Twitter both answered the Twitter call, and they told me they just put it in the toolbar as an option. To do this, you right-click in the toolbar, choose Customize, and then drag the icon for superscript and subscript right into the toolbar. So Kim, when you do switch to Pages, there's a much easier way than any of the other options. But let's get back to your immediate problem. How do you do superscript in something like Notational Velocity? Well, if your text program doesn't have a built-in superscript feature, you can always use what's called the character viewer, that's built into OS X. First, I'll tell you how to get to it, then we'll talk to you about how to use it. Open up System Preferences, click on Language and Text. I know, it's a weird place to put this, but whatever, work with me. Then you click on the Input Sources tab. At the very top should be the Keyboard and Character Viewer. Make sure that box is checked, then down at the very bottom of the window, check the box that says Show Input in Menu Bar. Now, in your menu bar, probably close to the right, is this ugly little icon. Sort of a black box with some dots and a star. I'm not sure who made the icon, but it's ugly enough you're not going to get it mixed up with anything else. Now let's figure out how this helps us get to the superscript function. Open your text editor, like Notational Velocity or Feeder in my case. In Kim's example, she wanted to do 10 to the 10th, but let's do 10 squared so it's a little easier to keep track in our heads. So first, type in the number 10. Then click on the ugly character viewer icon in the menu bar. You're going to get two choices. Keyboard viewer, which is really handy for something completely separate. Use that if you want to find the key combo that lets you type an Apple icon, for example. It's very, very cool. Or how to like put the little tilde thing over an N when you're typing a Spanish name or word or something like that. It's really, really handy. That's probably better than the rest of this tip. The other choice is the character viewer. I know, we said it was a character viewer. You're going to click on character viewer to get to character viewer. Work with me. So set the pull down for view in the upper left to all characters. and then in the bottom right, use the search window to type in superscript and hit enter. Now you will have revealed an awful lot of glop, but at the top is a row of numbers from 0 to 9. Each one of those is a superscript code. So remember back about 45 minutes ago, I told you to type in the number 10? Now all you have to do is drag the 2 from the character viewer superscripts over to the 10, and you've got 10 squared. Wow, that was a lot of work, wasn't it? Well, if you're willing to stick with this, you can make your life a tad easier by selecting each of the numbers from 0 to 9 one by one, and then using the tiny gear in the bottom left, you can add them to favorites within the character viewer. Once you've done that, you'd only have to use the character viewer pull-down and then click on favorites, and they'd be right there. If, heaven forbid, though, you also need subscripts, you'd have to favorite each one of those, too. So basically, 20 operations. And sadly, once you've done that and you've got them all in your favorites, you're not going to be able to tell super and subscripts apart because they all look just like 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, that kind of thing. Let's say you needed a word superscripted or subscripted. This isn't going to help you do that at all. This might be a good argument to get a real text editor, though, wouldn't it? Even plain old text edit lets you use the menus to choose format, baseline, superscript. I also tested it with the free Bean word processor, which is fantastic, by the way, and they made it the easiest of all. Just select font, pull down to super slash sub, and you get options for super and subscript. Probably the most intuitive of all the options I looked like. Well, Kim, that sounded like a dumb question, but I sure managed to make a doctoral dissertation out of it, didn't I? You've probably gone back to a pen and paper by now.
Hi, Alison, and of course, when these are the castaways, I hope you're well. I'm somewhere in Roma chat room. Am I talking to myself? I don't know. Hi, future Stu. Okay, that out of the way, I'm here today to be a little bit naughty. I'm here to break Apple's NDA. Yes, I know, it's a terrible thing. Anyway, I'm here to tell your fantastic listeners about something really cool that Apple have implemented into Lion. Basically, for visually impaired users, Apple have some fantastic accessibility features, including voiceover and the screen zooming. Now, I think that's pretty awesome. I mean, you don't tend to get that in Windows, at least not to the same quality, not in my experience. Apple have taken it to another level, though. In Lion, what they've done is added a feature called the zoom-in window. And this effectively, rather than you zooming into an area of the screen and the whole screen is zoomed, this now gives you effectively a magnifying lens. And you can move your mouse around or use your fingers on a magic trackpad or your MacBook's trackpad, whatever you have. And it will follow you around. And you can then see a zoomed in area in that window. It's a really nice idea. You can also invert the colours just within that area. You can smooth images. You can set the magnification window to be this follow around lens, or you can dock it into a certain position. You can control the size of the lens. You can align it to the edges of your screen, whatever works best for you. And to me, that means Apple are giving you more flexibility of how you control the screen zoom. Now, in general, I don't need to use the screen zoom unless I'm out and about and I just have a MacBook Pro with me. A 24-inch cinema display is pretty big, even for my terrible eyesight. But it is a really nice feature for them to add. It's going to be part of Lion. It works really well already, and we're not even at Gold Master yet. So congratulations, Apple. I hope that's going to be a compelling reason for a lot of the visually impaired Nozilla castaways to upgrade to Lion. I mean, I can't see any reason not to. That's just my opinion, by the way. So I guess that's it. And I still haven't come up with my own way to end things. So until next time, castaway on? I don't know. Someone come up with something. And bye, future Stu. Did you get all the work done today? No? Why are you in the chat room, man? Nick will kill you. All right, bye.
Stu, I love this. I'm not visually impaired yet anyway, but I am aging and my vision isn't what it used to be. I use control scroll from time to time on my laptop to just zoom in, but this would be way better. I also have a Mac Mini connected to a 50-inch TV, and the resolution is way too high, so it's virtually impossible to read browser text or iTunes text. I know I can Command Plus it up on the browser at least, but that puts less stuff on the screen. The zoom in window feature, which by the way, you guys, Stu told me on the side can be triggered with a keystroke, which is ideal, Anyway, the zoom in window feature will be way better to keep everything on screen, and I can just slide it around until I can find what I'm looking for. If you're visually impaired, it's going to be really fantastic. Thanks, Stu. Now, get back to work before Nick catches you. So I've brought in a very special Nosilla Castaway for a special segment here today. How are you today, Steve?
I'm very happy today. Glad to be back with the Nosilla Castaways.
Well, they love it when you're on the air. Anyway, we wanted to talk about a little experiment you and I have been running where a couple years ago you got a Flipmino HD. I think it was around 2009, might even have been earlier than that. And then recently we picked up a Sony Bloggy Touch that's a much, much newer model. And we decided to do some experiments recording the two, using the two devices to record video together. Mm-hmm. So going into this, I expected the Sony Bloggy to blow out the Flipmino, especially with 2 years earlier, device. I thought it wouldn't be quite as good. But let's talk about what we did here. And for everyone listening, you can also go to the website. We're going to have a video that Steve's been working on where he compared the two cameras output together in a lot of different conditions. And so you can actually see what we're talking about when we get there. But let's talk first about video quality.
Okay. We looked at both good lighting and poor or low lighting conditions. So they performed a little differently in those two conditions. Good lighting, we saw the Bloggy had a slight blue shift in the coloration. The Mino color balance seemed to be pretty good under good lighting conditions.
It was just a slight blue shift, though. It wasn't bad, right?
Very slight, yeah. And you could only see it when you compare them side by side.
And one thing I thought was interesting was the Bloggy has image stabilization. So you could actually see as we took a part of it, we were driving in the car, and you could see it sort of looks like we're floating in a boat instead of jiggling in a car.
Yeah, but to be fair, Flip, since the 2009 model that we reviewed, has added image stabilization, but you really do need that feature with these small video cams to help stabilize that image.
Yeah, because sometimes the small camera is actually more difficult to hold still than the big one, right?
Right.
Now, you've used your Flip Mino for just all kinds of things. You take it everywhere, right?
Yeah, it's really handy. It's just so small. It fits in the pocket. A lot less volume and space to take up, and it's handy just to turn on, flip out, and get some video going right away.
Yeah. Now, how about low light? We took it to a really tough condition. We took it to a restaurant at night, so it was barely lit. I mean, there was a lot of candlelight, maybe some low incandescent lights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's where the Mino's color balance really got a little bit screwy. It had a pretty pronounced red shift, I'd say much more so than the Bloggy's slight blue shift during normal light. The Bloggy, on the other hand, had a little more trouble focusing. It does have an autofocus feature.
But in low light, it didn't keep up. It literally couldn't find a focus point a couple times.
Yeah, and you kind of expect that under low light conditions. But it's worthy to note that the Mino has a fixed focal length with no autofocus. It's really wide field of view, so you don't run into that condition. There's no focusing needed in general.
Right. Actually, I don't think you mean wide field of view. I think you mean
depth of field. Right.
Depth of view. Yeah. So now, one thing, it's not going to look, you're not going to actually see in the video what I'm exclaiming about so much, but I noticed my son started moving his head and a little square was on the screen on his head. And as he moved around, that little square moved around. So mm-hmm. It was actually doing some face tracking, which was pretty cool, but it looks just stupid because he starts moving his head a bunch in the video.
Yeah. Well, that's Kyle.
Yeah, there you go.
The other thing worth noting is under low light, the Bloggy showed some compression effects. You know that effect where you have fewer color gradients and so the image starts to look a little cartoonish?
Yeah.
I did see some of that, and I think that's probably due to the compression that the Bloggy applies to the video image much more so than the Mino.
Okay. Now, the reason I corrected you on field of view was I was really impressed with the wideness of the field of view on the Bloggy.
Right. That's been one of my complaints with the Mino. Even at its widest field of view, it's just zoomed up too close. I feel like I want to back up all the time to get the entire scene in.
And that's actually something that drives you crazy with your Canon prosumer camera as well, right?
Yeah, that also has a pretty narrow field of view at its widest setting.
Right, right. That makes it kind of annoying. So I definitely like the Bloggy a lot better because of that.
Yeah, I think it's just roughly it looked about twice the field of view at its widest setting.
Now, you've complained over and over again about the audio pickup on the Mino, not necessarily that it's poor quality, but that you just can't hear it.
Yeah, that's probably my biggest complaint with the Flip Mino. Its audio mic, its mic is just not sensitive enough. Recorded audio is just too quiet, and it introduces some background hiss.
Hmm.
So when I edit, I usually have to crank up the Mino's volume by 12 dB, which is the max I can do in Final Cut, to get a volume that's even close to the other audio clips. And that's still sometimes not enough.
So that's when you're mixing in Mino video with your Canon video together?
Yeah, when I want those audio clips to be roughly comparable without having to, you know, go in and equalize too much.
Now, the Mino is also only mono, and the Bloggy was stereo. Is that right?
That's right. And the Bloggy stereo audio was pretty good, much better than the Mino, produces volume much comparable to other recording devices.
Now, that turned out to have some penalties to it, right?
Yeah. There is a downside to that high audio sensitivity. We did some recording in windy conditions and in the car. And I'll tell you, the wind was just almost overpowering, could almost not hear our voices in some cases.
I noticed that in the restaurant, too, is it was almost like it picked up a low rumble. I think it picks up low frequency a little better than it should.
It does. And I think under regular conditions, whatever that might be, this isn't a problem. But any background extraneous noise, like a restaurant or a convention, that it's going to have a little trouble there.
Now, the Bloggy has a 12-megapixel camera in it, not a super high-quality camera or anything like that, but and you can set it to lower-resolution photos. That's kind of neat because if you've got that one device with you, it'd be nice to be able to snap photos when you need to, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah, nice little feature.
The Bloggy is a touchscreen device. They call it the Sony Bloggy Touch. It's got a 3-inch screen that's actually a wide format screen, which is kind of nice. I think that display is a lot better than the Flip.
Yeah, it's certainly bigger, and I think the controls were a little more intuitive with the touch controls. The zoom was easier to operate, and a couple other things were just simpler.
The Bloggy and the Mino both are 8-gigabyte devices. They're basically just have a USB stick or a USB connector that pops out of the side of them. And the Bloggy is 1080p, where the Mino is 720p. But for some reason, the Bloggy said it had 4 hours of video it could do, and the Mino only 2. Why would that be?
Yeah, that's kind of odd because they both record MP4, but I think the Bloggy does more compression. And, we could see telltales of that with the cartoonish-like video under low light. I think it's the combination of that and possibly half the frame recording rate for the Bloggy, probably at 30 versus the 60 frames per second with the Mino.
Yeah, why did they do 60 frames a second anyway on the Mino? Nothing does that, right?
Yeah, but you could ask the same about the 1080p. That's really not required for these little small video cams.
It's sort of like putting a 12-megapixel camera in it.
Yeah. It's great for the brochures.
But. Not just because you can, right?
Right?
Well, we should mention that the Mino is actually a discontinued product. Flip was purchased by Cisco, and Cisco chose to shut the business down and not spin it off again, which a lot of people are upset by because people just love those little Flip cameras. But we decided to go ahead with the review anyway because they are still available for purchase. I saw an ad in Best Buy today, and I put a link in the show notes from Amazon. The Mino runs about $80 to $112 were the different kind of price ranges I saw. And the Sony Bloggy Touch is actually like around $170, $180. So if you had to do a price-for-performance ratio on that, which one would you pick?
I think I would pick the Mino over the two, between the Bloggy and the Mino. You can live with the low audio sensitivity. It's annoying, but when you put everything together, I think the Mino wins this contest, and for the price especially.
Now, but I didn't like the performance of the Mino in the low light enough that I really would have given the edge to the Sony Bloggy Touch. I think that the video quality to me, even with the artifacts, looked a lot better to me than the Mino. So I actually would pick the Bloggy, and I like the touchscreen interface too.
Okay. Well, there is one caveat to all this, and that is, what is the camera that you have with you at the time? And for those of you that have iPhones, I don't, but many of you do, That's probably the best video camera you're going to have on you at all times. And in that case, the iPhone might actually do quite well. And someday we may want to compare it with the iPhone.
Right, right. That's probably the way to go. Well, since we've kind of given a vote on both sides, why don't you guys go over to the show notes and take a look at the video Steve created. He did some cool stuff bringing down the bloggy video and bringing up the flip and switching them so that you can really see the audio differences between them. And he's got the two videos side by side, so it looks pretty cool, like you'll really be able to make your own decision on this important issue. All right, Steve, I really appreciate you coming on and doing this recording to us. And you want to say goodbye to the No Silly Castaways there?
Yeah, thanks for having me back, Allison. It's always fun being right on the show.
Not behind the scenes, huh?
Right.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
I was typing away in Feeder this weekend, writing up my show notes as always, and I noticed it was fixing my typos as I typed. I'd never really noticed that before, and so I went hunting around the Feeder menus for an autocorrect function, but it wasn't there to be found. Then I realized what was happening. One of the coolest unsung values of Text Expander is the autocorrect section. Without me doing a darn thing, the folks at Smile had just started fixing my typos automatically. If you type one of the words that they have the common misspellings for, if you type that in, it just fixes it. There are 112 commonly misspelled words already corrected for you in Text Expander, and of course you can add in your own as well. Now, I can hear you saying, well, Word has that, but you're not always in Word. If you have Text Expander enabled, you're always in Text Expander, so whatever application in which you write has one source of autocorrect. It is simply awesome. Now, a lot of you already have Text Expander, I bet. So if you do, how about you recommend it to a friend or family member and ask them to make sure they say they got the idea from the No Silly Cast? That can help the show just as much as just about anything. And you're giving the gift of efficiency to your friends and family, too. I'm sure you and they will love it as much as I do. Head on over to smilesoftware.com and download the free trial if you don't believe me. And then when you do love it, make sure you tell them that you heard about it on the No Silly Cast. I've been thinking a lot lately about paper versus electronic things to read. There's three angles I want to take on this: books, magazines, and newspapers. I want to separate these three because so far the examples I've seen of the electronic versions of these three things are very different, some good, some bad. Let's start with books. I love to read. I can remember when I was a little girl and we'd be sailing past some magnificent bluffs in Wisconsin, having sailed through the night to cross Lake Michigan from Charlevoix just to see these beautiful bluffs. I'd have my nose in a book engrossed in the plot, and my mother would be badgering me that I should be enjoying the view. I resented her intrusion into the world in which I was immersed. Now, of course, today I understand what I was missing, but books were and still are an entrancing thing for me. It was hard for me to choose to simply sit up and look over the tow rail to see this breathtaking view. Well, the advent of the electronic books on the Kindle intrigued me, but I hadn't quite jumped when the iPad came out. Shortly after I got my iPad, though, I promptly downloaded the four applications: Kindle, Nook, iBooks, and Borders. I did a fly-off on show number 272 in August of 2010, and after that, I chose the Kindle app over the other three. Ever since then, I've been voraciously devouring books in my iPad. I love that it's there with me at all times. I read mostly at night before I go to bed, so a backlit display is actually ideal for me. I experiment from time to time with white text on black, sepia tones, different font sizes, and I've come up with a combination that works for me. I do have to avoid the temptation to hit that home button, flip over to my tweet peeps, but if the book is worthy, that doesn't happen until I'm done reading for the night. Oddly, I don't actually miss paper books. I don't like the thickness, I don't like the weight, and how about those annoying, badly printed books? You know, the ones that are hard to read because the binding's too tight and you can't quite easily read the words towards the middle? That drives me nuts. I actually made a pact with myself at one point to only read Penguin books because they printed their books in a way that made them easy to open and read. But now I don't have to worry about that at all, and I don't miss it. After I switched overnight to reading exclusively on the iPad, I noticed an increase in cost of reading for me, though. I realized that I wasn't hardly ever buying books on my own back in the paper days. My friends Marion and Diane would always buy books and just hand them to me and say, "Read this." On occasion, my mother-in-law would jump in with a book when we'd be visiting, too. I think I probably bought like 1 to 2 books a year, but I was reading 1 to 2 books a month. Well, suddenly I'm paying full price for books every time I want to buy them. The one-click ordering online on the device is so compelling, I don't even think about it. Well, that is until my credit card bill comes. Now let's talk about newspapers. I love the Wall Street Journal. My father and father-in-law both turned me on to it, and it's kind of part of my morning ritual. I would love to be retired and get to pore over the whole paper, but with all that work nonsense getting in my way, I don't get to read as much as I'd like. Here's my process. I start with the far left column, which is the business section. Even though my dad told me to read the one to the right to get situational awareness of what's going on in the world, my eyes do wander over there from time to time, but it's the far left section that really grabs my eye. I scan for the name of technology companies, and I note the section where those articles are contained, usually over in Marketplace. I glance at whatever huge photo is on the upper top right to see if there's anything of interest. Usually not. Then I flip the paper over and I look at the article at the bottom center of the page. This article is always interesting and never anything I would normally look for. One time it was about stray dogs that ride the subway in New York. Once it was about a blind guy who sails solo with a camera strapped to his hat and a laptop slung over his shoulder, sending the imagery back to shore for the captain to tell him where to go. You absolutely cannot predict what you're going to learn about in this strange little column. I adore it. Then I flip to Marketplace and read any and all tech-related articles. Along with my paid subscription to the print edition comes free access to the iPad app. I reviewed it when it first came out. It's dreadful. Perhaps it's from 50 years of understanding how to navigate a newspaper, but the Wall Street Journal iPad app just doesn't move correctly. Let's say you want to flip the front section over to see that strange column in the bottom center. If I try scrolling up with my finger on the iPad version, it changes to the next section of the newspaper, which I would sort of picture being to the right, not down below. I have to scroll side to side to stay within the same section. It's not intuitive to me. So if you look for those two columns that were on the left that I talked about, the business and world section, those are spread out across page after page after page instead of just all being together. Now, I know there have to be ads, even though I'm paying $100 plus a year to have the subscription, but the way the ads are done in the Wall Street Journal app are really, truly annoying. Is really, truly annoying. Keep my verb straight. Anyway, let's say we read page one, and we scroll to the right to get to page two. Scroll again to get to page three. Scroll back, you'd expect to get to page two, but instead it's a full page ad. It's like they're these little treats and you don't know where and how they're going to show up. Except they're not treats. Even more annoying, if you try to scroll up to change sections, it often triggers a full page ad there too. The articles are split up all over the place and it takes ages and ages to download this paper. On my 15 megabits per second broadband connection, which normally runs even faster than that, around 20 to 25, it took slightly over 2 minutes to download Saturday's Wall Street Journal. If you're running out the door and you want to grab the paper, 2 minutes is an eternity. I really should time how long it would take on 3G. One other observation. When I look at the electronic version of the Wall Street Journal on the iPad or the online web version, which is way better than the iPad app, I find that I only read the tech articles. They give me the option of jumping to just that one thing I'm interested in, which at first blush you would think would make me happy, but how will I ever learn about dogs riding the subway or blind sailors? I have no opportunity, unless I dig around, to casually stumble across things outside my field because they make it too easy for me to stay inside my little tech box. Now, while ebooks have solved a lot of problems for me, the e-paper in this particular example was a much worse experience. Carrying around a giant dead tree edition of the paper isn't exactly convenient, but at least the reading experience is delightful, and that's what it's really all about. Okay, on to magazines. I'm an avid reader of Wired magazine and no other magazines at all. It's just that one. Wired is great because it has lots of tech-related articles, and they stretch my brain well past the traditional tech stories. I read an article once about how obesity runs in neighborhoods. I learned about a guy who was mapping his daughter's DNA to try to find a cure for her odd disease. He was doing it, like, in a closet in his house. I learned about video recordings you can put on your tombstone to give a cheerful greeting to those visiting you while you're lounging in the afterlife. This magazine, Wired, is absolutely awesome. I read it sitting in the gym lounge after working out while I eat my lunch. Now imagine my delight when I got a free subscription to the electronic version of Wired. I thought it might lighten my load going to the gym to not have to carry the magazine, since I always have my iPad with me. While I was at home, I decided to download the latest issue to the iPad, since 3G access is virtually non-existent inside the gym, and I was a little worried it would be pretty slow. So here I am at home, again on my 15 megabit per second download broadband. It started to download, and download, and download. I mean, this thing was so bad it made the Wall Street Journal download look positively snappy. The worst part is, I'd look over and it would say paused. I didn't ask it to pause, it just decided to pause. On and off, I kept trying it whenever I didn't need to be actually using the iPad. Over the course of 2 days, I fought with this darn thing to get it to come down. It kept up with that pausing return even when I begged it to start back up again. I tweeted about that and others confirmed that they were having the same problem. So finally, after a couple of days, I had my Wired magazine on my iPad and I took it to the gym. I started trying to read articles, actually rereading some of the ones I'd read in paper just to kind of compare the experiences. I gotta tell you, I hate the Wired iPad version of the magazine. Imagine reading an article that has small, tasteful illustrations to the side, but while you're reading, the illustration just starts to move for no reason. They've animated things for the sake of animating. Figures dance around, people move their hands. Distracting, to say the least. It was so annoying. Next, I got to a page that had been full page in the magazine, but since the iPad screen is smaller, they took pieces of the article and made them accessible only if you click on these little buttons to get them to fall down to be visible. Not only that, these little pieces and these little windows that came down, the windows were too small, so you actually had to scroll up and down in these tiny little pull-down windows to read what it was supposed to say. Oh, and ads, ads, ads. Every 1 to 3 pages is an ad. Now, Wired is so inexpensive, the ads are forgivable in paper. The magazine is only $10 a year, and I always kind of wish they'd charge me a little more for it because, I mean, I don't know how they stay in business at that rate. But somehow, they were even worse than the app. I found this experience so annoying that I never even got to a page with video where they said that that would really add, you know, value to my experience beyond what I got out of static paper. I hate every minute of using the Wired magazine app on the iPad. So, bottom line, replacing paper with electronic forms evidently requires some logic, user testing, interface consultants, I don't know what, but it seems really, really easy to do it very badly. For now, I'm sticking with paper for the newspaper, paper for the magazines, but the books have been done so well, I'm delighted to have them with me on my iPad, iPhone, and Mac. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond. And now we have the other half, perhaps the better half, of the My Mac podcast, Guy Searle. We've had Gaz on before, but this first time we've had Gaz on, our Guy on. How you doing, Guy?
I'm doing great. I'm not so sure that the better half would be a good description of the partnership between guests.
The taller half.
Okay, yeah, I'll go with that. Yeah, I'm definitely taller.
Well, we had the pleasure to finally actually meet. Now, this is interesting. One host is in England, one in where you're in the East Coast somewhere?
Yeah, I'm in Alexandria, Virginia.
And I've met both of you.
I've never met Gaz, ever.
Oh, that's funny. He's a lot of fun. I actually enjoyed him quite a bit.
He's got like this like rounded kind of weird head with weird hair, and I don't think that's quite.
Well, he does
really
look kind of like that, but. Well, anyway, we wanted to get on the show together and talk. This is going to be kind of an inside baseball show. It's going to be about podcasting, and I'm actually really looking forward to this because I set my path and how I was going to do things so long ago now that there's a lot of tools and things out there that I probably don't even know about that, you know, once I got it working, you don't want to disrupt it because it is such a house of cards sometimes to get it to work.
Oh, yeah. I know all about that.
Hence the 5 minutes it took us to actually make this Skype call work, right?
Yeah. Well, Skype is not always your best friend.
Right. Except when it always is, right?
Yeah. Except when it works. Then it's great.
So where do you want to start us off?
You want to talk about tools?
Sure.
I mean, as far as like hardware and software?
Yeah. So what do you use to record the show?
Well, currently, I'm on a 2007 era Mac Pro that I picked up used, and it's a 3 gigahertz or has two dual core 3 gigahertz processors. You know, the Intel Xeon processors, and so far it's been great. You know, I've got 8 gigs of RAM in it, and all the rest of the little happy doodads that go with a machine like that, and I just love it. It's,
I remember when you got it, and you were suffering the GarageBand freezing disk is too slow errors, which, by the way, I don't think ever means your disk is too slow. It means something, but we just don't know what it means.
Right. It's one of those generic error messages that just tell you so much and yet so little.
Microsoft would give you a 16-digit binary code for the error. Apple gives you an error that means nothing either, but it makes you feel like you should know, right?
Yeah. It's kind of like, okay, well, this isn't really the error, but it's something you'll understand.
Okay. So what kind of mic do you use?
I use a Samson CO3U USB mic. I've got it in a... NADA, or maybe it's NADI SSPF-4 cradle and a pop filter, and just to keep it off of my desk, because anytime you hit the desk with a microphone that's on your desk, you pick up all that wonderful noise too. I've got it in a Heil PL-2T microphone boom. Yay.
Oh, cool. You know, I think the microphone boom was one of the coolest things Steve got me, because I used to have this standing mic stand thing that weighed about 370 pounds, and I'd be, lifting it, moving it to the other side. I mean, it wasn't moving on its own, that's for sure.
No.
The only problem I have with my pop filter is I get distracted by thinking, is it doing its job correctly? So I have a habit of doing this, which I did in the middle of chit-chat last week. Ready? Listen.
I'm ready.
Isn't that nice? That's me rotating it. And for some reason, I think, I could just do that and they won't hear this big. I do it.
Oh, by the way, it was great to hear Bart last week.
Oh, wasn't that fantastic?
Because I know he's kind of been off the radar for a while.
Oh, like 8 months. Yeah, that was. Oh, I just held a hand in my heart when I heard his voice for the first time in so long.
Yeah,
you know, that was.
Yeah, and a little bit more inside baseball. I was actually supposed to be on the show last week.
That's right, and I blew you off for a bigger name.
Totally blew me off. But when you sent me the email and said that Bart was going to be on, I was like, oh, that no problem. I mean, it's
that's
just,
the one name I'm allowed to blow you off for. Right?
Sure. Well, him or Steve Jobs. Maybe Steve Jobs.
Maybe. I probably still wouldn't do it. Yeah, you know, that actually reminds me of a really, really cool guy I met at the D9 conference. Matt, I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, McInnes from Inkling. I waited to do an interview with this guy. And right when I got my turn to talk to him, Larry Magid from CBS News insisted on talking to him right then. And
of course he did.
And I only have 5 minutes. And Matt looked at me and he just kind of gives me this plaintive look. And I said, dude, it's okay. I get bigger name on the other line. And he looks at me and he goes, okay, so he's being rude and you're being nice. And you're saying, I have to go talk to him. And I loved it. I thought it was a great reaction to it. And he's just like, what are you going to do?
Did he actually say it to the guy's face?
No. Larry was maybe 10 feet away, and it was one of his employees that was coming over and telling him, Larry has to talk right now. So anyway, I thought the guy handled it really well, and he shot me an email shortly afterwards saying, hey, when can we talk? So I'll still get to talk to him. Very cool guy. Anyway, yep. Boy, we went in a circle there.
Oh, believe me, if for anyone that listens to the MyMac.com podcast, tangents are the rule of the day.
You told me before we started that the MyMac.com podcast was laser focused on the subject.
No, that was the previous versions of the MyMac.
That was before you took over.
Yeah. Because Tim Robertson actually started the show back in 2004. He was like, one of the first ones out there. And when he would do the show with Chad, and then later on with several of the other co-hosts, myself included, he always kind of knew where he was taking the show, and he had kind of usually had a topic that was kind of a topic. Yeah. I have tried to do podcasts by myself, and
it's hard.
It is very hard, and it's almost always been a miserable failure. I really need somebody to play off of, which is why when Gaz first came onto the show, and I could tell right away that he had a similar, let's just say, warped sense of humor.
And like, the love like of banter, was. Right?
Yeah. Well, if you're going to podcast, you have to love to talk.
Right, right. And in fact, that's how you got on the show, was you sent me a chat that said, hey, I like to talk. How come I haven't been on Chit Chat?
Well, I wasn't across the pond. I'm not even on the other side of the Potomac from you.
Yeah, we're not even trying to pretend it's across a pond anymore. Yeah,
I think there's some big lakes in Minnesota that are between us that we can just call it that.
Right, right. There is a reason I call Chit Chat Across the Pond my favorite time of the week, because this is the easy part. I make the guests do all the show notes, and then I just get to talk to you. And that's a heck of a lot easier than the first half of the show, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, Gaz and I, we use Google Docs to kind of, you know, put the topics that it is we're going to talk about and whatever feedback that we have from Twitter, or, you know, we have a Facebook page set up for the show now, so on and so forth. And then we usually have a couple of topics, because we do like three. We try to make them 15 minutes long, but they never are. They're never 15 minutes long. So, you know, we have these topics that we set up for each segment. And sometimes we get to them all and sometimes we don't. But, yeah, well, as long as we're having a good time with it.
Yeah, and that definitely comes through on the show. You guys are always enjoying yourselves, and I think that's what makes the audience enjoy it. Yeah. So back to tools. What do you wrote? What software?
Right.
We're almost done with number two. So what do you use to record during the actual setup when you're recording?
Well, I know a lot of people like to use like either Wiretap Studio or Audio Hijack Pro. I actually still use GarageBand, and the reason why I like using GarageBand is that it gives me the ability, with some other software that we'll go into later, to record people and various things that we do on individual tracks, which means that later on when I'm in the editing process, if somebody's microphone is a little hot, I can bring it down, or if they're a little low, I can bring them up, and it's not going to affect, like, if I was recording Gaz and myself and, you know, soundboard and everything else that we're doing on one track, and I was hot and he wasn't, I have no way to adjust my volume while not adjusting his. So by using GarageBand, I'm able to have everybody on a separate track. I can put in whatever filters I want and adjust the volume and all these other happy, happy stuff.
Yeah, so that's an interesting difference. So the way I do mine, I record that my part of the show is in GarageBand, but mm-hmm. I can stop. And so I don't like to do any post-process editing. So I record myself, and when I flub up, or the chat room tells me I flubbed up, except last week, they were fired earlier in this episode because they didn't tell me. I said I've been podcasting since 2006, and it was 5 years, and it was 2005 and 6 years.
Oh, math fail.
Yeah, I know. They're fired. But anyway, I can just stop, go back, and fix it real time when I'm in GarageBand.
Sure.
However, when you and I are talking right now, I'm using Wiretap Studio because in general, it just goes straight through. There's not a lot of stopping. And let's say your phone rings or you belch or something like that. I just write down the time, and it's real easy to just go through and go zzz and cut a piece out, and it pulls together. I found with GarageBand, I have to cut things and then slide things, and then I accidentally don't move one of the tracks, and it's a big mess.
Right.
So when it's just two people, I get us on two different tracks, so I do still have that separation that I can change the audio, and I can just, you know, delete something you said.
Well, believe there's lots of times on the show I wish I could delete something I just said.
But describe what the tracks are that you use.
Yeah, track one I use for my microphone. Track two I use for Skype, which is going to be Gaz and whoever else that we're talking to via Skype. Now, track three is the track that has the most controversy.
Hang on. You're piping Skype as an audio input into a track?
Yes.
I did not know you could do that. That's kind of cool.
Well, I will explain how to do that in a little bit.
Oh, talk about the controversial track now.
Okay. The controversial track is from Ambrosia Software's soundboard.
And I think it should be taken away from you.
Lots of people have said that as well.
And I think that makes you enjoy it all the more.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. You would have to pry soundboard from my cold, dead hands. I love soundboard and all the things I can do with it. As a courtesy, I do not currently have it running. So I'm not going to regale you with all the different
You're behaving yourself. Huh? All right.
Well, as much as I possibly can. Now, tracks 4 and 5 are typically used for post-production. Track 4 is for commercials and show bumpers. And by show bumpers, it's a little thing where you actually recorded one for us for the 300th podcast, where it's like, you know, I'm Allison Sheridan, and I never listen to Guy and Gaz, the G-Men, on the MyMac.com podcast, or something along those lines. We actually have a contest going right now for people to send us bumpers. And if we like them, I'm going to send them. Do you know what an iHub is?
No, uh-uh.
iHub is, there's this Chinese company that made these 4-port USB hubs with Apple's logo on them. And gosh darn it, they just didn't get Apple's permission to do that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, I managed to get 10 of these. And I bought them myself. So, you know, it's not like, you know, they sent them to me as a promo or anything along those lines. And anyone in continental U.S. who sends me a bumper that we like, I'm going to send them an iHub, and it's all out of pocket. Cute. That's all out of pocket for me. So track 4 is commercials and show bumpers. Track 5 I use for the iTunes songs that I play between the segments.
So I want to interrupt you there for a minute.
Yeah.
One of the things I enjoy about podcasting is we all get these little phrases that we do repeatedly, and then it causes other people to hear it in their head when they're about to say something. Like, I know if anyone ever tries to say ever so slight, they have to say ever so slight, right?
Of course. Of course.
But what happens to me is as soon as someone says stand by to stand by.
You think of our show?
I instantly think of it. And it's I think it's a good thing, right, as it gets you into that. But why are we standing by? Why do you stop and then start again?
Well, I think part of it is – you know, and because when I first started doing the show and when it was, you know, on me to do the show, I had a 2.16 gigahertz 24-inch iMac.
Give it a rest, a timeout?
Yeah. Well, not so much to give it a rest, but to just save whatever I've currently done in GarageBand.
Right. Oh, yeah, you got to save in GarageBand. I learned that one.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So that way it allows me to save the file so no matter what happens when we start to record the next segment, I still have that previous segment done. It's good. I don't have to, you know, even if the absolute worst happens and GarageBand totally crashes on me, that's there.
At least you got half a show.
Well, I got something.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds so like you've run into it as well.
Oh, many, many times. And not just the two slow disk errors. I have had a couple of GarageBand crashes while doing the show, but not with the Mac Pro so far, you know, knock wood. As I hit my head,
I had a lot of trouble with GarageBand 9 on my old machine. It seems to be going okay on the new one, but it would just lock up my entire machine. And so the live chat's like, where's Allison? And they can't see me. And luckily I have a moderator in my house that I can go, GarageBand, gosh darn servers. I finally scraped it off. I had to go back to iTunes 8 or to GarageBand 8. So the chat room learned to yell, save. All the time to me.
All the time.
That's pretty much their primary function.
Yeah. So
I might have to unfire them now that I think about that.
Well, you don't want to lose them. Yeah. And you know, I wish I could, and I probably could have it set up to where I have a live audience going on in the background as well. Mm-hmm. But sometimes, because I've done, have you ever done the IMP podcast?
Yeah. And I've been, we were in the chat room just yesterday listening and playing around with those guys.
Yeah. Having a chat room while you're trying to record a show, and especially if you're trying to moderate a show, can be so distracting that you'll end up getting off topic from whatever it was you were actually
trying to talk. You would lose your laser focus?
Yeah. Well, I think the laser was like made back in 1955.
A little bit on the diffuse side, huh?
Yeah, just a bit.
Well, that is one thing. I don't look at the chat until I stop. So since I'm not talking to anybody, I can stop anytime I want. So I just hit pause, you know, stop the recording for a little bit, chat with the audience for a while, and then go back in. So they mostly like to talk to each other, though. I don't think they're that interested in talking to me anyway.
Well, I know part of the problem that we have with the MyMac show is, and it's not so much that it's a problem, it's just the way things are. Gary's in the UK, and I'm here in DC, East Coast.
Wait, who's Gary?
Gazmatch.
Oh,
sorry. I hope I didn't out him or anything. So, but he's 5 hours behind me. I'm sorry, 5 hours ahead of me. Mm-hmm. So when we record on Tuesdays, it's 5 p.m. my time and it's 10 p.m. his time. So I try to get through it as quickly as I can, just so that, you know, he's not up until 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. O'clock in the morning. So it's more of a courtesy to Gaz that
to keep going.
Just to keep going as quickly as I possibly can.
Now, you do some interesting things with Wiretap Anywhere and Skype and GarageBand. Explain how that works.
Yeah, Wiretap. Now, this is also from Ambrosia Software. And Wiretap Anywhere, the first version of it, was usable but occasionally difficult to set up. And what it basically does is it takes all of these audio sources from within your computer and allow you to make virtual devices so that they're always coming out on a particular track. And the new version of Wiretap Anywhere is marvelous because it actually has like a graphical interface, and you basically drag wires from your various sources, whether it's a soundboard or a Skype or your microphone or whatever, to actual audio inputs that can be seen in GarageBand. So that's how I'm able to say, okay, Skype is always going to be on tracks 3 and 4. My microphone is always going to be on tracks 1 and 2. Soundboard's always going to be on 5 and 6. And then I do the same thing. I actually have two different virtual Wiretap Anywhere devices made.
Hang on a second. Why is your voice on 2 tracks?
Just left and right channel.
You're mono. By definition, you're mono.
Mono-y-mono. Well, it's just the way that it's set up. I suppose I could probably do it in a couple of different ways, but so far, again, knock wood, that's the way that it
this
works.
This is sort of like what I was talking about, right? You don't want to bump the table.
I don't want to bump the table. Bumping the table is bad.
I'll never forget. This is another side lobe story, but I'll never forget. I was I'm flying along doing the live show, and I mean, you know, I'm spinning at least 48 plates when I'm doing the live show. You know,
oh, yeah.
I mean, it is
well,
insane.
I've been there when you've done them.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I flubbed a word, and this kid, I forget who it was, because he never came back because I yelled at him. I still feel bad about that. All he did was write the word fail. And I stopped the recording, and I knew he was a musician. He played in an orchestra, and I said, okay, you're playing the piccolo part to Vivaldi, which has about 48,000 notes in 3 or 4 measures alone, and you miss one note, and someone whispers in your ear, fail. What happens to the rest of that song? You know, I was so angry that he did that, and I'm like, geez, Al, you got to get a little perspective here.
Well, yeah, but I mean, if he was doing it over and over.
Yeah, he did it once. I can't even remember who it was, but yeah, I still feel bad about that.
Well, but he typed it in more than once, though, didn't he? Or
no,
was it
I
just
think he
that
typed
one
it once. I'm a bad person. But
oh,
anyway.
That's bad. Naughty.
So,
naughty Allison.
I don't know why I told that story. Now I'm embarrassed. But anyway. So,
well, you've
so
got to leave it in now.
You said, no, I have the edit key. but I already confessed I don't do any editing. So you've got two of these Wiretap Anywhere devices?
Yes.
Virtual devices?
Yeah, I've got one that I've got that's sending all the audio sources into GarageBand. So in GarageBand preferences, the input is set up to this Wiretap Anywhere device, and the output goes to my headphones so that I can monitor it live. Now, on the other side of things, I have another Wiretap Anywhere device that's made up of soundboard, iTunes, and my microphone, and that's going into the input of Skype. So this
oh,
way.
Oh, right, right. So right. You basically have a virtual mixer.
Exactly. Now, I tried using a mixer some time ago, and it was just cables everywhere, and it never seemed to work quite the way I wanted it to. And it really kind of gave me mixed results. And this is when I need soundboard, because I could have hit a button and just had like all these people laughing in the background. But that's okay.
I have one in a box in the closet.
Yeah, what was it? I had an Alesis USB multi-mix. You know, it had 8 inputs and USB output, but it would never allow me to have multiple tracks in GarageBand. I couldn't send the individual sources to individual tracks, which is really what I wanted.
Right.
So that's when I started looking for software solutions, and that's when I ran across Wiretap Anywhere.
Well, I'm glad to hear Wiretap Anywhere is working better for you now. I had was in the beta test program for that, and then when it came out for real, I was all excited, and I was using it. And then one episode, I did an entire interview where it shifted the two audio tracks by like 5 seconds.
Oh.
Only they weren't separate tracks. They were one track.
And
I lost the whole interview. And they couldn't figure out how it happened. And it was just like, you know, you're burned once like that. You're just like, oh, I can't take that kind of risk, you know? I mean, I lost an interview. And it was with somebody I couldn't get another interview with. Mm. I was so bummed. So I was
nervous. Was that for version 1 or version 2?
Oh, definitely version 1. I mean, like version 0.9 possibly. I mean, it was way back. So,
well, version 2 of Wiretap Anywhere. I swear Ambrosia should be paying me for this. Version 2 of Wiretap Anywhere really, really works well. And the thing you have to remember with software like this is – don't screw with the default settings, because if you do, bad things will happen. Because
are they the ones that actually have a note about that? They say probably something like, "Don't touch this. Close this window. Stop looking here."
Probably, if they don't, they should. But I find that it allows me to do everything that I need to do, both going out from my computer to whoever it is I'm going to be talking to via Skype, and also going into GarageBand, so everything that I'm doing live is being recorded.
If it's not intellectual property, would you mind taking a screenshot of what that looks like when you've got all those little virtual wires connected?
Yeah, I can take a screenshot of that and send it to you.
That'd be really, really cool. All right, let's get into soundboard.
Okay, well, the nice – and this is also from Ambrosia Software. Soundboard is pretty much what it sounds like. If you've ever been inside of a radio station and seen, you know, all the carts that they used to use that would have commercials on them or would have little bumpers on them, or even you know, whatever the top 10 songs that they're playing every hour has on it, they just kind of hit a button and, you know, they're switching carts on and off. They'll have like eight carts in a particular machine, and then a little board that matches up to each one of those carts. So they just hit a button and it starts to play and goes through, you know, whatever audio mixer that it is that they're using. Well, soundboard works pretty much the same way, except you can have basically multiple soundboards, and each one of the carts from within the program corresponds to a key on your keyboard. So I can just hit the letter Q and that particular little sound bit will play. And, you know, it's the way I first started using it, and the way I still kind of use it today, is when we get calls in from Skype or, you know, through email or whatever, I'll turn those into an MP3, usually with, like, you know, Wiretap Studio, and then drop those onto a soundboard bit. And as I'm talking to Gaz, I'll say, okay, well, we just got a call from Allison Sheridan, and here it is. Click, and it starts to play. Gaz can hear it. GarageBand is recording it, and there's no, you know, back in the day, we would have to actually stop recording, and then Tim would have to play the audio bit so we could all hear it, and then he would drop it into GarageBand, and then we would start to record again and make comments on it.
Well, that sounds like an acceptable use of soundboard, Guy.
Yeah, well, it is. And it's more along the lines of what it was intended for. But I always like to push the envelope. That's just what I do.
You know, Victor Cahiao, I did want to give a plug here. The Typical Mac User podcast and Typical Shutterbug spent probably 10 hours trying to explain to me how that mixer works. And I do feel bad that I would still use it. But he's also a big fan of soundboard. He taught me about that, too. The fact that I don't do it truly live, you know, I stop and start. It didn't really fill a need for me, but I can see how the way you're doing it, it would really work well. Now, how do they hear the file when you drop it in?
You mean when I actually play it in soundboard?
Yeah. Do you play it in soundboard, or does it just get dropped into GarageBand and that's when he hears it?
No, it's actually playing through soundboard's interface, but because I have soundboard in the Wiretap Anywhere's virtual devices going both to Skype and to GarageBand on a separate track, it plays it both to Skype and into GarageBand at the same time.
Oh, I see. You're never dropping it into GarageBand. It's hearing it. GarageBand is hearing it as though it were a microphone input.
Yep, and it's on a separate track, so it's completely editable if something happens to it.
Cool. You know, I was going to suggest that this was going to be a content-free episode because you and I can get real silly together, but this is this is actual content, Guy. You've thrown me for a loop here.
Yeah, well, and plus we can be silly at the same time.
Which, back to soundboard.
Oh, okay.
Whose name is it that's always mispronounced?
Oh, Elisa Pacelli. Or Pacelli. I just mispronounced her name. Elisa Pacelli, and then there's also Suze Gilbert. So they sent me little clips. So they write content for mymac.com on the website. So as we're going through all of the stuff that's come through the website over that particular week, when we get to their name, and Gaz knows I do it every single time. So he'll like purposely mispronounce Elisa's name. And then I'll just hit that little thing, it's Pacelli, not Pacelli, you nitwit Brit, or however that goes. And then we have a guy in the UK, Paul Shadwell, who goes by...
I know Paul?
Yeah, Jolly Jap.
Paul is Jolly Jap?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Wait, you guys, Paul is... I would give you a... he would give you a run for your money on height. You're probably a little bit taller. He is a great big guy. Harley rider. He's Jolly Jap. Oh, and he's Swiss, I think? No, he lives in Switzerland, but he's British.
I think he's originally from the UK.
Why is he Jolly Jap?
I have no idea.
I did not know that. That is so funny. I talk to him all the time. I talk to Jolly Jap constantly. I never knew it was Paul.
He's a great guy. So I have a sound bit from him because I used to say Jolly Jape. Ah. So he said, and based on what we had done with Elisa, he sent me this thing saying, it's Jolly Jap, not Jolly Jape, you big Yank tank.
Right.
So it works out well. So we've got somebody there to insult Gaz and someone there to insult me.
Well, that's good. It's good that it goes both ways.
Sure.
Okay, now, sometimes you use, let me guess, it's from Ambrosia again, Wiretap Studio. What do you use that for?
I use Wiretap Studio for, creating sound bits or to, like when we get a call in from Skype, there'll be some dead air before or some dead air after. And the problem with Skype, when you get a recorded phone call, at least version 5 doesn't have any way to output that. You can listen to it, but you can't save it as a file. At least not that I've been able to figure out. So I'll start up Wiretap Studio, play the
have Skype
call.
Be an input.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then play the call from Skype. Record that in Wiretap Studio. Cut out the dead air before and after, and then drop it in the soundboard.
Okay. And then Gaz uses it too?
Yeah, mostly as revenge. Just to get back at me.
Wait, in the show notes you said, Gaz uses this when recording live as a backup in case my setup explodes into shards of glass and death rays.
Yeah. Yeah, well he's using – yeah, I'm sorry. You're right. I forgot about that. He's using Wiretap Studio as the backup. So if something happens – in the middle of an interview or, I suddenly Cylon out on Skype, he's able to send me his file because he's recording in two different tracks, one for his microphone and then one for Skype. And he's able, if mine goes crazy, he's able to send me mine. Or if his goes crazy on my end, he's able to send me his, and I can just drop that into GarageBand as a separate track.
There you go. And if, so if he's recording Skype, that's picking up all of these other goofy things like your soundboard stuff, right?
Yes.
Because if he could hear it, then Wiretap Studio can hear it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a nice – and there are other programs that will allow you to do all these same things that I'm talking about. But I have been a big supporter of Ambrosia software for a long time. I think they just either make or have some great developers. Now, when Wiretap Anywhere, I had some problems with it because I had done what I had said earlier not to do, which was change some default settings. And it added a second and a half delay into Skype. Yeah. So we did this one show. As a matter of fact, we were interviewing Elisa Pacelli. And we
Is
had
that Pacelli
this,
or Pacelli? Oh, sorry.
I'm not sure. I'd
Is
have to go
fault?
Back and listen. But there was a second and a half delay, and it really made for a very awkward show because you're constantly, talking over someone, and then they stop in the middle of what was they were going to say. And you know, latency is audio's worst enemy.
Oh, yeah. Latency for the flow and for the ability to have a normal conversation. It sure is.
Yeah, sure is.
It's amazing how well it does work. I mean, considering you're talking to someone, 5,000 miles away.
Yeah, more or less.
Yeah.
And you know, I was talking to Elisa, who's over, I think, she's up in New York. I was down here in D.C., and Gaz was in the U.K., and when, you know, the latency problems don't happen, there's probably like a quarter second to a half second delay, which you can't, you know, I mean, it's just the nature of the beast because it's going from their computer to a server to another server to the servers over here. You just can't get away from that. But just the fact that it works at all.
I know. Well, we complain a lot about Skype, but really, you know, first of all, we're not paying them anything right now.
Exactly.
I successfully did an interview with Kirshen, who was in England at the time, and Alistair Jenks, who was in New Zealand at the time.
Oh, yeah, I remember
so,
that.
I don't know. That was like 126 time zones apart by the time we were done. And it was completely fluid. You know, she was on her iPhone doing Skype from 8,000 miles away from me. And I couldn't even begin to tell you how far away Alistair is because he goes forward in time. So he's like sometime tomorrow. So I don't know.
Yeah, Skype, when it works great. And we all sing its praises until it doesn't.
And then we're a bunch of big fat whiners.
That's right. I don't like you anymore, Skype.
So, Microsoft Skype. So, after doing all of this, I'm guessing you've got to be a Levelator user because your audio is always great.
Yeah. Well, a Levelator is – I actually keep that on my desktop. That's one of the programs I just keep right there. And of course, you know, it's just an alias. But I just like to have it and see it there. So, after we get done recording – and I add in the little 30-second music bits and the commercials and the bumpers and everything else, I'll take that entire track, export it out of GarageBand as an AIFF file.
So uncompressed at that point.
Uncompressed, yep. Drop that onto Levelator, which will, you know, do its little magic in at least trying to make all the tracks the same volume. And it'll give you another output, which I then drop into iTunes. And once that's in iTunes, I add all the metadata. And once that's done, I turn it into an MP3.
What I like is at that point, you've now got 1, 2, 3, 4 copies of the uncompressed audio file.
Yeah.
So you've got like 2 gigs of your disk are gone. 2 to 3 gigs of your disk, right?
Oh, an hour show can easily run 500 to 750 megabytes.
Right, right. Now, anybody who's thinking about doing a podcast, if you've got all inspired by this discussion or anything, if you do one thing based on what Guy has said, use Levelator.
Yes.
I decided to try a new podcast, and I won't embarrass them here, but it's actually not a new show. It's been around quite a while. I don't know. They had like 30 or 40 episodes, and I was all excited. Oh, it's going to be really cool. This new show I'd heard about is great, and immediately I shut it off because the volume was completely different from person to person. They had 4 people on, and it could not have been more distracting and annoying, and I'm just not going to listen to it. You can – if you do – well, we were talking about Alex Lindsay earlier today. He's a big video guy, a big photography guy, big video guy. And he was asked on stage once, what's the most important thing to know about video? And he said, audio.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, audio, audio, audio. He said, people will forgive bad video. I mean, how many bad videos have you watched on YouTube, right? Horrible quality. But
sure.
if the audio is good, you'll still watch.
Yeah. Or on HBO. But that, I think that's up for a whole different reason.
That's another discussion, right? Now, you've got an awful lot of stuff running at the same time. How do you manage that screen-wise?
Well, I actually have 2 different monitors. Before, when I had the iMac, of course, I had the 24-inch monitor that came with the iMac. And then I also had a 22-inch Acer LCD display. So I kind of spread things out that way.
Yeah, I think that's pretty essential. You can't be doing this on a 13-inch MacBook Pro.
No, not without... You know, hitting what's that called, where everything just kind of slides out of the way?
Oh, spaces.
Yeah, not spaces. You hit a button and
expose.
Thank you. Yeah, even longtime Mac guys sometimes can get tripped up by various Apple phraseology. Yeah, I just made up a new word.
I definitely lose those things. I'm losing nouns right and left, that's for sure. Well, this has been really fun. We haven't actually talked about what you talk about. How do you keep your laser focus? What is your topic set?
Topic set. Now, one of the things that we try not to do, but sometimes you can't help it, is we basically try to stay away from the news, because you know there are a lot of shows out there that is, you know, going into the minute details of what's been going on in the Mac universe for the past week. And so we try to take topics that not only do we think that our audience is going to enjoy, but things that we're going to enjoy. Not even necessarily things we know that much about, but just something that we'll enjoy talking about. Oh yeah. Oh, knowledge is definitely, you know, you don't have to be an expert to be able to do something fun and creative on your Macintosh. And let's face it, that's the real reason why we use Macintosh computers as compared. And, you know, I don't want to slam Windows. I think Windows 7 is a fine OS, but it gets in your way. It doesn't help with the creative process. Like right now, my son is making a couple of movies for an end of year projects at his school. And if, you know, he usually uses iMovie, but now he's starting to get into using
Final Cut?
No. Well, I have Final Cut Pro, Adobe Premiere Elements.
Oh, I've heard good things about that.
Oh, it is actually, in many ways, I prefer, and this might sound like blasphemy, I prefer Premiere Elements over Final Cut. I think it has a much cleaner workflow. You're able to do things with filters from right within the track that Final Cut Pro in its current form. Now, who knows what it'll look like when Final Cut Pro X comes out, but in its current form, you have to go to several different places to do it. I really like Adobe Premiere Elements. And it's cheap. It's like $80.
That might be an interesting compromise. I just don't grok iMovie. I don't understand it at all. I mostly just swear at it the entire time I'm having anything to do with it. And I don't have the bandwidth to figure out Final Cut Express for how much I use it. Final Cut X, I'll start on that one, since we'll be able to get a family pack in theory from the App Store.
Right. You can put it on multiple computers.
Right. So I might give that a try, but I just don't get iMovie at all, the new version. I've watched Don try to explain it to us and I still don't get it.
Well, I remember back in the day using iMovie 06 and lower, where everything the way iMovie used to be set up was a very simple interface. One click would get you to titles. One click would get you to filters. One click would get you to transitions. And
you had a timeline across the bottom. You dragged things in. You set your music.
Exactly.
It worked. Exactly.
And then iMovie for iLife 07 came out.
Is that where it went bad? It was iMovie HD that was still good, right? That was the last good one, I think.
I think so. I'm sure the chat room was probably screaming, no. The last version before they completely changed the interface. And when I first saw that interface, because I've gotten, you know, like most Mac users, I've gotten every single version of iLife that's ever come out. And when they completely changed the interface, which of course also killed all the third party development that was being done. What is that guy's name? He's in every single Mac world. He used to do a lot of stuff with third-party development. G3 Software.
Okay.
Bruce G. And he had like all these filters and transitions and all this stuff that was built into the previous version of iMovie that just made it such a great program. I mean, the only thing that iMovie has never really had is multiple tracks. But with all this stuff that Bruce G's G3 Software put in, it made it completely usable to do things like this.
Okay.
And then that was all thrown out the window
when they wrecked it.
Yeah, when the new interface came out. Now, the version of iMovie that they currently have in iLife 11, I just tried it for the first time a couple of weeks ago, and it is better as far as dealing with
sucks
the video.
Less, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. That's kind of the best way you can describe it. It sucks less than the previous versions, which is not a a blazing recommendation, I understand. But it's why basically the new version of iMovie from like 08 and 09 and so on was why I ended up getting Final Cut, because I just couldn't stand the new version of iMovie. But now that I've been using Adobe Premiere Elements, that may be all I use for a while. It gives me everything I need, multiple tracks with both video and audio, filters and all the rest of that, and it's easy to use.
That really sounds like it might be the way to go. Well, let's take a look and see what Final Cut X has to offer. And
yeah, exactly.
Never know. Well, hey, we are out of time.
No. We have so much more to talk about.
I know. You've got like 28 more paragraphs to go. But
well, we can do it another time.
I'm going to cut you off. Yeah, I like to leave everybody with the tease. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Like I said, I thought it was going to be a content-free show because when we met in real life, it was a bit sillier.
yeah, you had me taking pictures.
That was fun. Yeah. But anyway, why don't you have let people know where they can find you?
Well, I can be reached at guy@mymac.com. You can also find me on the Twitters at MacParrot. Rawr! I had to do that because Gaz's not here. And we also have a Facebook page. Just type in MyMac space podcast and don't actually type out the word space. And you can find us on Facebook.
Wow, that's awesome.
And of course, we're in iTunes.
In iTunes naturally. And on your favorite MP3 players everywhere.
Of course.
All right. So, thanks a lot, Guy.
Oh, you're very welcome. Good night, everybody.
You know, Guy and I have so much fun together. I was a little worried that this would be a content-free section, but we managed to actually stay on topic, and I learned a lot. I'm not saying I'm going to run out and get soundboard and start dropping in Donald Duck quotes in the middle of Bart explaining asymmetric encryption or anything like that, but I'm sure I'm going to use some of what Guy taught me. Now let's also get a show of hands. How many people were screaming at their iPods when Guy went off on his description of how Paul Shadwell goes by Jolly Jap on Twitter? Probably the real Jolly Jap might have been yelling at his iPod, and certainly Paul Shadwell would be. A few days after we recorded, Guy wrote to me to tell me he realized later it's Paul Bartlett who goes by Jolly Jap, not Paul Shadwell. I thought that whole thing sounded weird. Paul Shadwell, oddly enough, goes by @PaulShadwell on Twitter. They're both lovely gentlemen, and you should follow them both. Anyway, I had a blast with Guy, as you can tell. Well, that's going to wind things up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsors for helping to pay the bills, Screen Steps, and of course, Smile. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com, follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet, and if you want to join in the live show and have a lot of fun with the No Silly Castaways, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time. In there, you'll find instructions to watch the live video, join in the chat room, listen to audio only if you happen to be out and about and you want to do it on your iPad or your iPhone, that sort of thing. And I guarantee you'll have a lot of fun. Heck, this week, what were they talking about? Let's see, decaf espresso and black holes appears to be the topic for right now. And I know there was a lot of discussion of what was the worst thing you ever did to a microwave. And some occasions they actually listen to what I'm talking about, but mostly they're just off having their own fun. Anyway, I hope you can join them sometime Sunday nights, 5 p.m. Pacific time at podfeet.com/live. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.